support room, a group of students from Lincoln High School, Wisconsin Rapids. We had this, your colleagues, earlier at 10:45, and you all spent part of the lunch hour with Justice Wilcox. So would all the students from Lincoln High School please rise so we can see you. Well, greetings, and we hope that you will enjoy the oral argument and that you enjoyed your time with Justice Wilcox. You may be seated, please. These students are here, as they know, but some of the others in the courtroom might not, with the Supreme Court and State Bar program called Court with Class. And this is an award-winning program that we've had the honor to put on for about 2 years. So now that you all have been introduced to the court, I would like to introduce the court to you. On my far right is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left is Justice John Wilcox, and to my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz, and I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage, and to his left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser. And with those introductory remarks completed, we will call our third case today, which is 97-2932 CR and 97-2933 CR, State v. Kivioja. Have I pronounced it correctly?
Very close.
Kivioja?
Kivioja.
Good.
Pronounce the J.
I understand.
The one responding to the pronunciation is Mark G. Sukowdy. Okay. Sukawati. Well, that's all the syllables. Thank you. And you are representing the defendant here. Okay, you may take the podium, please. Thank you.
As the court may be aware, this case involves two consolidated cases concerning several burglaries to home residences and related matters. My client, Mr. Dennis Kivioja, entered a plea of no contest in a single hearing to both of these matters. Later on, he wanted to withdraw that plea. He wanted to withdraw that plea before sentencing because a co-defendant, Mr. Jody Steele, recanted his entire accusation against my client, and he recanted so under oath. Now, this case has dealt with recantations before, most recently in a few years ago, but not in a case of pre-sentence plea withdrawal. Pre-sentence plea withdrawal has been clear in the state of Wisconsin since the 1973 case of State versus Lipke, where this court set forth the standard, a different standard for plea withdrawal before sentencing, that is, the simple, fair, and just reason standard. In 1989, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals put a gloss on that, changing it to, or I should say, adding to it, a plausible, fair, and just reason for plea withdrawal before sentencing in the state of Wisconsin under Wisconsin law. In this case, the trial court went beyond that standard, went beyond it considerably. It took into consideration what this court said in the McCallum case, which concerned recantation and plea withdrawal after sentencing. In both of these cases, whether it's before sentencing or after, I think it might be fair to say that the recantation itself could be considered newly discovered evidence, for it was not available at the time the plea was entered. But I don't know if the court has the briefs in front of it. If it does, at page 103 of my blue brief, in the appendix, page 103, you will find the trial court order, which is really at issue here. That trial court order is dated March 13, 1997, a month short of 2 years ago. In that order, the trial court sets forth three things that it finds. Clearly, the trial court is in error and is requiring more of my client to withdraw his plea before sentencing than the law under the state of Wisconsin has ever required for plea withdrawal before sentencing.
Would you go through that I guess what I see, two reasons. The reasonable jury set forth in number one and the corroboration set forth in number two. And contrast those elements with what you believe is law right now in the state.
The law right now of the state, as I mentioned, Your Honor, is a fair and just reason, and more specifically, plausible fair and just reason.
I see, and I read this as number three being the defendant has failed to present a fair and just reason for withdrawing his pleas. I found that to be the conclusion. He didn't say, therefore, I can conclude. And that the way that I interpreted that conclusion, which is the correct standard, based on the two elements set forth in number one and two. So tell me why the two elements set forth in number one and two are inconsistent or contrary with existing law.
Well, both one and two go to the McCallum case, really. They go to the McCallum case, which is plea withdrawal after sentencing. Now, the cooperation requirement was set forth in the, I think it was 1995 McCallum case, or 97. The Supreme Court decision was 97 for the McCallum case. But the whole reason there, and that was plea withdrawal after sentencing. And McCallum is different from this.
Maybe let me focus my question then. With regard, is it your belief that with regard to pre-sentence withdrawal based on recantation, that there is no need for corroboration?
Correct. And the state concedes so in its brief, Your Honor.
With regard to number one, the standard a reasonable jury would not believe, is it your belief that that's the post-sentence standard and that the pre-sentence standard is plausibility based on, what is it, Stank or something?
I would go so far as to say the first paragraph of the judge's finding in the trial court that a reasonable jury would not believe is not even the law under McCallum, because McCallum goes right to the reasonable doubt. This is going to pre-McCallum law, and this, actually, the first paragraph is what this court reversed in McCallum, as far as I'm concerned, because McCallum says, if anything at all, it says it must be for the jury to decide whether there is a reasonable doubt. That reasonable doubt standard is the standard up and down the law of criminal law in the state of Wisconsin and in the whole United States and in England. The reasonable doubt standard has to be there in any criminal case. And in this case, and in McCallum, this court brought it out again. Reasonable doubt is what rules, not what the jury might believe or not believe. For the jury might disbelieve both stories of the witness, if the witness, in fact, committed perjury under one or both stories. But if I may digress a little bit, in this case, we have only one sworn statement. The first statements my client made were only to the police. They were never sworn to in court before my client entered his no contest pleas. This case is so different, and that is why the state is conceding there's no corroboration requirement here, because there is only one sworn statement. That sworn statement came in the recantation after my client entered his plea. And so, unlike McCallum, where this court said the witness had to be committing perjury under either the first sworn statement or the latter, in this case, Mr. Jody Steele, for what you might think of his credibility, does not necessarily have to be committing perjury. And so this is where the state has to concede that cooperation is not even required in this matter. Under the facts of this case, cooperation would not even be required if this were a post-sentence plea withdrawal. And that is why the trial court is in plain error as a matter of law, under the legal standards, under paragraph 2, where it says no corroboration of Jody Steele's recantation. That is clearly wrong under McCallum, and I still want to stress to this court that we are not dealing with a McCallum post-sentence plea withdrawal case. This is different from McCallum, as I've been saying time and time again. This is a pre-sentence plea withdrawal, and the legal standard for this has been always simply a fair and just reason. And since 1989, State v. Shanks, the Court of Appeals opinion, it is a plausible fair and just reason. Now,
Mr. Superati, let me, if I might, interrupt for a minute. Do you think that credibility enters at all into the hearing, when you have a hearing on a motion to withdraw a plea prior to sentencing? Do you feel that credibility is at all an issue?
I have looked through the law of the state of Wisconsin, and I have looked through federal case law under the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure number 32 and the recent Supreme Court case of Hyde, the U.S. Supreme Court case of Hyde. I have found nothing to go to any credibility determination, Your Honor, concerning pre-sentence plea withdrawal.
Well, let me give you a hypothetical, if I might. Let's assume that you've got a defendant who takes the stand at the plea withdrawal hearing. And my understanding and my experience as a trial judge was that it often was the case that the defendant would do so. and that the defendant would start talking about the fact that he or she was not guilty, that he or she had a defense, perhaps that he or she did not understand what was going on at the plea hearing, perhaps that he or she was rushed into the plea by the attorney. That's pretty standard to hear at a plea withdrawal hearing, because quite obviously the defendant is trying to set forth a record that would justify the fair and reasonable standard. Now, do you feel that the trial judge cannot determine whether or not the testimony of such a defendant is credible?
Yes, Your Honor, for this reason. The Court of Appeals brought out the word, the adjective, plausible. Everybody who has ever been a trial court judge knows that when you're talking about plausibility, it usually comes right to a preliminary hearing in a felony case. At that point, the trial judge, as this court has instructed them, never considers the witness's credibility, and yet at the preliminary hearing stage in a felony case, credibility is never determined, but somebody can be put on trial, what is called being found over for trial, without any credibility determination. As a defense attorney, I have many times tried to bring in credibility issues in a preliminary hearing to be quickly objected to successfully by state prosecutors as saying, you can't go into credibility in a preliminary hearing. Only plausibility can be used in a preliminary hearing.
Well, aren't you extending Shanks beyond what Shanks really says? The Shanks court didn't say that the trial judge cannot consider the credibility of the various witnesses that he or she is hearing at a plea withdrawal motion hearing. It talked about a plausible, fair, and just reason, but I don't think that you can take that to the point of saying the judge has no right to make any determinations of credibility. I mean, you've got, at least I'm asking if you've got other authority that would justify that position other than Shanks.
Not beyond those cases I cited in my briefs, Your Honor. But again, as a defense attorney, I try both cases in the trial court and I take appeals, Your Honor. And when my ears hear the word plausibility, I am well aware of what this court has done in distinguishing plausibility from credibility during preliminary hearings over the last decade.
I'm well aware of that also, and my ear rings the same when I hear plausibility. I say, oh, credibility isn't relevant in a plausibility determination, because I hearken to the rule of thumb, if you will, well, not the rule of thumb, the rule of law, for preliminary hearing. Nevertheless, how do you harmonize that with the apparent approval of the trial court assessing credibility in the Kennedy case? Both the Kennedy case, as cited by the Court of Appeals certification, cited at page 4, citing page 585 of the Kennedy case, indicates that the trial court assessed credibility and did not believe Kennedy's asserted reasons for withdrawal of plea, and therefore did not think they were fair and just. How do you reconcile?
Kennedy, I looked at, Your Honor, but Kennedy is not a recantation case. And that's where I found the first distinction between Kennedy and the instant case before the court.
What difference does that make? Because we're dealing with, it may make a difference, but you'll have to explain it to me, because we're dealing with pre-sentence plea withdrawal. I know involving a recantation. Are you asserting that you can use credibility assessments in recantation, but for no other reason in a pre-sentence plea withdrawal?
No, but this would be the difference. In the instant case, we have a witness who first implicated my client, not under oath, just by statements to the police. In the Kennedy case, it was the defendant himself with no other evidence saying, I want to withdraw my plea. And it was in the Kennedy case that the court said that the trial court could disbelieve that. If this court is going to come to some sort of sliding scale rule for credibility or plausibility or something in between the two to decide this case, I think you have to take into consideration those cases where, as Justice Crooks pointed out, the defendant himself says, I want to withdraw my plea. Here we have a case where the defendant is sitting back, he already entered his plea, and just 2 weeks after he enters his plea, the co-defendant comes up and says, this guy didn't do anything. He wasn't part of it. And the co-defendant, Jody Steele, says this for the first time under oath. But whenever you get back to credibility, Your Honors, whenever you get back to credibility, you usually think of the jury. Should not the jury be making that credibility determination? And should not that determination be made beyond a reasonable doubt? When you hook the two up of the jury determination, unanimously, not one, not 11, but unanimously, and deciding that beyond a reasonable doubt, I think that is the overriding concern, and I think that overshadows everything else.
So, just so I understand, so the standard that you're asking this court to set, what just lay it out, what are you talking about exactly?
I'm an old school guy, Your Honor. I'm saying the standard is and should remain a fair and just reason, and I would say a plausible fair and just reason. Leave the credibility determination ultimately for the jury, and leave that jury decide that unanimously beyond a reasonable doubt.
I have trouble figuring out how you make a finding of fair and reasonable, plausible statement without determining credibility. How do you know where truth is? We're always looking for truth. We may have a sham, and a judge still isn't able to look at the credibility?
There are lots of things that are shams, Your Honors.
Not in court, hopefully.
Pardon?
Not in court, hopefully.
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor.
We're here to make sure there isn't.
But if we are, in this case, if we are to give any greater support to a statement made under oath than to a statement not made under oath, then we are back to letting the jury decide it, Your Honor. For in this case, we have only one statement under oath. That is the recantation. And does a statement under oath carry any more weight than a statement not under oath?
I think, why don't you ask President Clinton?
I was heading toward the Washington, D.C. direction, Your Honor.
But the one original statement by this co-conspirator or co-defendant, the result of it was somebody getting a prison sentence. Pretty important effect.
Exactly, Your Honor, and this is where I bring out that part of a preliminary hearing using plausibility. Day in, day out, preliminary hearings are held throughout this state. Day in, day out, defense attorneys cannot go into credibility at a preliminary hearing. They're limited to plausibility and to the distinctions that this court has recently made within the last 10 years between plausibility and credibility at a preliminary hearing. I cite one or two cases in my briefs concerning preliminary hearings and the rulings this court has made on that subject. To a lot of people, the difference between a plausible statement and a credible statement is hard to distinguish. It is for trial attorneys, especially those at a preliminary hearing sometimes. But I think when the ultimate credibility determination is to be made, we're still looking at the unanimous 12-person jury and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That reasonable doubt standard rings back and forth through the McCallum case. And once again, I do not concede that McCallum has any bearing on this matter because it is a post-sentencing plea withdrawal case. But if we must get to McCallum sooner or later, there's one thing that rings back and forth through it, and that is the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, not what the jury believes. If I may say this, Your Honors, we're talking about what the judge believes. What if the jury doesn't believe any statement at all, but still has that reasonable doubt? Certainly, under pre-sentence plea withdrawal, I think we'd have to concede that my client has a right to that pre-sentence plea withdrawal. Not even, and this isn't post-sentence. Now, post-sentence, it's still for the jury beyond a reasonable doubt, but in before sentencing withdrawal of a plea, that beyond a reasonable doubt standard really has to stand strong and in front when considering the decision in this case and my client's desire to withdraw his plea. It was not my client who made that sworn statement. It was the other person, Jordy Steele. Now, as we all know, when you have several people charged with a crime, they are called co-defendants. And for many years, courts high and low, federal and state, have always been wary about what one co-defendant will say against another. And they might not believe it one bit. And the jury might not believe it one bit. But if that jury has a reasonable doubt, if one person out of 12 on that jury has a reasonable doubt, that is the overriding concern in our system of criminal justice, high and low, state and federal courts.
Mr. Tawadi, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to these from the record, but was the defendant charged with this burglary at the Meisenberg home?
He was.
And did Mr. Steele say he didn't participate in that?
I read through the, I believe it's March 1997 plea withdrawal transcript. I read through that just recently again to refresh my own recollection. And as I recall, Mr. Steele, a person you might not want to ever have lunch with, basically says my client was not involved in any of these at all and never had anything to do with any of these burglaries.
What I'm trying to get at is, I understood that Mr. Steele at one time said I was in jail at the time of the Meisenberg burglary, and then later said I wasn't in jail. And I'd like to know whether he was in jail or not.
As far as I can tell, Your Honor, there's no clear evidence to say one way or the other. And if there's no clear evidence to say one way or the other, we are back to the credibility determination by the jury, by unanimous jury, beyond a reasonable doubt, all 12 people on that jury without one having a reasonable doubt. Again, the jury might disbelieve everything that comes out of Jody Steele's mouth. Everything. And so how could the trial judge make that credibility determination if the jury says we don't believe one word, and yet the jury finds him not guilty beyond a reasonable doubt? Remember, the word's not guilty. It doesn't say he's a good person. It doesn't say anything about him at all. It just says that the jury cannot find this person guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That's another way of looking at that.
What if the judge knew that Mr. Steele was in jail at the time of the Meisenberg burglary, so that his recantation really, at least on that point, doesn't hold up? Is that credibility, or is that plausibility, or both?
In this particular case, Your Honor, for the record, there's nothing in the record to show that clear evidence one way or the other.
And well, so, hypothetically,
if that judge went back to the jailer's records, and if that judge somehow knew the exact time and day that burglary happened at the Meisenberg home...
Counsel, if you'd stand in front of the microphone, please.
And if that judge knew exactly those facts, that judge might want to say that on the record. But we don't have that on the record, Your Honor. The more criminal cases you see, you'll see you never know when the homeowner can determine the exact time of the burglary, for one. You might be able to determine the day, but you probably won't get the exact hour and minute of the burglary happening. The only time you get cases that are so clear in the facts is perhaps a bank robbery, where you have bank cameras that can zero in on a bank robbery happening in 1 minute on one particular day. And then you can get that close to facts, Your Honor. But in burglaries like this and crimes of everyday occurrence, it's almost unheard of for anything to be pinned down that exactly.
Well, shouldn't the judge at least be able to look behind this co-conspirator? There are 30-some burglaries in this case. 23 were read in, 10 he pled, no contest.
There are many here, Your Honor.
Why shouldn't the judge want to know and be entitled to know why this recanter is now suddenly saying the things I told you about 33 burglaries were what was wrong? Why? I understand there's something in here that your client threatened the steal. Now, I don't know when the threat took place, whether it was after Steele was convicted and before your client was convicted, or just what the progress was of those facts.
And what is the court's question?
Well, why shouldn't the judge be able to look behind? Suppose what I've read in the record is borne out, and that is that there were threats made against Steele, the co-conspirator, by your client. That would be a good incentive for recanting.
Except under the facts of this record, Your Honor, Mr. Steele was shipped out of state to a different prison already, and this matter was not very fresh. This matter had been sitting around before my client entered his plea for over a year, I think. And it wasn't the matter of just 2 or 3 weeks in the local county jail. This matter had been gone on for over a year. Mr. Jody Steele had been shipped out of the Fond du Lac County Jail to either a different county or even to a prison out of the state of Wisconsin already. And so they were pretty far apart at that time. And that's the best answer I can give the court.
I was just looking for the authority of the judge. What, why a judge in making the determination of letting him withdraw the plea shouldn't know everything before he makes a decision.
Anything else?
Justice Prosser has a question for you.
I'm embarrassed. I don't know the answer to this, but if you prevail, can any of the evidence at the time the plea was given be used against the defendant? Any of the material from the hearing when you pled no contest, can that be used against the defendant or not?
As as far...
Like a confession. Is that evidence or is that off the record?
The fact that he entered a no contest plea, yeah. And the prosecutor come in to trial later on and ask him, didn't you enter this no contest plea? I think the answer to that would be no, that could not be used against him, because he would be starting over from the situation he was in before he entered his plea. And I do not think that that plea would be used against him. I have never seen a single case, on appeal or otherwise, for any defendant in state or federal court has ever had to face that situation that he entered a no contest plea before. And we do want to keep in mind there is a subtle difference between a no contest plea and a guilty plea. And I don't think that that would be proper. In fact, that could be something for a motion in limine before a trial, if there is going to be a trial. And I think it would be highly prejudicial and something that would be excluded by most trial court judges.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Tarver, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Sandy Tarver. I represent the state of Wisconsin. No evidence in the form of a recantation should constitute a fair and just reason to allow pre-sentence withdrawal of a plea only if, among other things, the recantation is accompanied by reasonable indicia of reliability. This court can determine from an independent review of the record that Jody Steele's recantation is not accompanied by reasonable indicia of reliability.
Make sure you speak up, please.
For this reason, the state asks that this court affirm the trial court's order denying Mr. Kibiyoja's motion for withdrawal of his plea. Now, I do intend to describe the rule that the state is proposing and the reasons for that, but before I do, I would like to explain the state's position on the role that credibility plays on pre-sentence motions for withdrawal of a plea. It is too sweeping an assertion to say that courts may not delve into credibility on pre-sentence plea withdrawal motions. That assertion fails to recognize an important distinction between two categories of plea withdrawal motions. And I'm critical of Mr. Kibiyoja's position for failing to make that distinction, but I admit that I have to turn that criticism on myself, because the state and the position it took in the Court of Appeals also failed to make that distinction. There are two categories of cases. One category of case is
what? Category is what?
One of the two categories is where the defendant comes in and says, Your Honor, I know I pled, but I misunderstood what I was doing. I was rushed. I was confused. I was misled. In that category of cases, the trial court is the finder of fact on the question whether the defendant was in fact misled. We know that misunderstanding the consequences of a plea constitutes a fair and just reason for plea withdrawal. So the question in those kinds of cases is, did the defendant in fact misunderstand? If he in fact misunderstood, he gets to withdraw his plea. But if he did not in fact misunderstand, he does not get to withdraw his plea. And the trial court is the finder of fact on the question whether he misunderstood or not. Now, in performing its function as the finder of fact in those kinds of cases, the trial court not only can, but must be permitted to assess the credibility of the defendant's claim. The trial court in those kinds of cases, as this court acknowledged in Kennedy, decides whether to believe the defendant or not, and that is proper. In contrast, when the defendant moves to withdraw his plea on the basis of new evidence, the trial court, the state is prepared to concede, is in a different posture. It is not the role of the trial court in a new evidence case to determine the ultimate question, is the new evidence, or the recantation in this case, true? That's not the issue on a plea withdrawal motion based on new evidence. Now, that is not to say, however, that the trial court should not be permitted to assess the defendant's proffered new evidence, to assess that recantation under some standard, and the state is proposing a standard, which it believes would be appropriate for courts to use on pre-sentence plea withdrawals based on new evidence and new evidence in the form of recantations. But the state concedes that it is not the role of the trial court in that category of cases to decide whether to believe the recanting witness is telling the truth or not. And for that reason, the state asks, that if this court in its ruling addresses the question whether courts can consider credibility in this case and answers the question no, it would be very important to limit that ruling to new evidence cases and not make a sweeping assertion somewhat like Mr. Kivioja has made that credibility cannot be considered at all on pre-sentence plea withdrawal motions.
I'm having a little difficulty understanding what to me seems a nuance. You say the trial court in recantation cannot assess credibility. Then earlier you said it can assess it under recantation. So you used assess both times, as I understood it. One saying it can't assess credibility, but it can assess credibility. And so I'm having a little difficulty.
Maybe I misspoke.
Are
you referring to something I said just now, or
yes,
something I said in the Court of Appeals?
No, just now.
Okay. What I meant to say is that in a new evidence case, the trial court is not permitted to make the ultimate finding. Is the recanting witness telling the truth or not? Was Mr. Kivioja involved in these burglaries or not? That's not the issue on a plea withdrawal motion. And in that sense of the word credibility, I mean to suggest that the trial court ought not engage in that kind of credibility assessment of the recantation. The state's position is, however, that, and I will describe the rule in greater detail, that the court in that situation should be permitted to assess the reliability of the recantation. And I'll go through that. Before I do, I'd like to make one other response to Mr. Kivioja's argument that plausibility, that the plausibility standard and the term plausibility suggests that under Wisconsin law, courts are precluded from delving into the credibility of witnesses on a pre-sentence plea withdrawal motion. Mr. Kivioja is relying on a statement in State v. Shanks by the Court of Appeals, where the Court of Appeals said at page 290, even where the reasons are fair and just, they must be supported by the evidence of record. Some courts have suggested that the reason offered must be plausible. State v. Shanks cites United States versus Navarro-Flores, a Ninth Circuit decision, in support of that proposition. The Ninth Circuit in Navarro-Flores said, it is the burden of the defendant to present a plausible reason for withdrawal. However, if you read Navarro-Flores, it is very clear that a plausible reason is meant to refer to a credible reason. A credible reason. There was the Navarro-Flores case presents the classic case of the defendant claiming that something happened at the plea withdrawal motion. He didn't understand what he was doing, and he should be permitted to withdraw his plea on that basis. In fact, specifically what happened in that case is that the defendant did not speak English, and at the time he entered his plea, he did so through a translator. He brought a pre-sentence plea withdrawal motion saying that the translation contained inaccuracies, that he had actually said that he was innocent, and that the translator had told him things that misled him. So at the hearing on the motion, the court heard testimony from the defendant and testimony from the translator, and their stories were quite different. It was a classic credibility contest. And the district court resolved the credibility contest against the defendant and denied the motion on the ground that the defendant's story was not credible. And the Ninth Circuit affirmed, specifically approving of the trial court's credibility determination. The Ninth Circuit said, in determining whether Navarro presented a plausible reason to support his motion, the weight to be given the evidence and the credibility of the witnesses is primarily a matter entrusted to the district court. I think it's clear under Navarro that plausibility, even when that term is used in the pre-sentence plea withdrawal context, does not mean that courts are not supposed to delve into the credibility of the witnesses.
Okay. I'm still having problems with what you said, though. That is, now you say there's a difference between assessing credibility and assessing reliability, and I'm missing that difference.
Why don't I turn to the rule then? And I'd like to just go through.
What are you going to turn to?
The rule that the state is proposing.
Okay.
If I may.
Why don't you give us the rule?
Okay. The state is proposing that the following rule apply to pre-sentence motions for plea withdrawal based on new evidence, including new evidence in the form of a recantation.
And remember, of course, that recantation is just a form of new evidence. So if this court adopts this rule, it's going to apply to new evidence of all kinds, not only recantations. New evidence should constitute a fair and just reason if the evidence was discovered after entry of the plea, the defendant was not negligent in seeking the evidence, the evidence is material to an issue in the case, and the evidence is not merely cumulative. These four criteria are taken from this court's decision in State v. McCollum. These are the first four criteria that apply on a post-sentence motion to withdraw a plea and motions for new trial. In addition, when the new evidence is a recantation, the trial court should be required to determine that the recantation is accompanied by reasonable indicia of reliability. In determining whether the recantation is accompanied by reasonable indicia of reliability, the trial court should consider the totality of the circumstances, including the following: the spontaneity of the recantation, the amount and quality of corroborating evidence.
The spontaneity, what was after that?
The spontaneity of the recantation, the amount and quality of corroborating evidence. Whether the recantation is self-incriminatory or against the penal interest of the recanting witness, and whether the recantation is under oath and subject to cross-examination.
Now, is this...
And subject to cross-examination.
Is this burden, quote, beyond a reasonable doubt, or is it by preponderance? What do you... The court looks at this book, excuse me. Well, I'm asking what the burden is, then after you look at those things that you suggested.
The state is proposing that the burden of proof be on the defendant to prove reasonable indicia of reliability by a preponderance of the evidence, and the state is borrowing the preponderance of the evidence burden from this court's decision in State v. Kennedy.
Can I just make a... Are you done with the rule?
I have things to add, but...
Well, let me just say, just as it goes this far, and maybe you have things to add, here you've got a plea, right? How many days expire before we're into the recantation here?
The plea was entered in October 1996, and the recantation...
Oh, well, when do they want to withdraw the plea?
The motion to withdraw is not filed until January of the following year. There's actually a lapse of some number of months.
So it's November and December, 2-3 months, let's say. So we're pretty fresh. By the time you finish this, and you've still got more, isn't it just easier to say, hey, withdraw the plea and go to trial? Why are we going through this?
Well, for these reasons. Yes, pre-sentence plea withdrawal should
That's
be
right.
more liberally granted
right.
than post-sentence plea withdrawal. The state has less interest in finality.
There's no prejudice here to the state.
Right.
Witnesses haven't died. All the evidence is as fresh as it was in October. And if you don't show prejudice, why don't you just open it up instead of having... You're going to have a trial here, a hearing here on all of this, and yet the guy doesn't get a chance to go to a judge or jury on the evidence.
Well, if what you're suggesting is why isn't a recantation a per se fair and just reason, the state's response to that is that as a matter of policy, a recantation should not constitute a per se fair and just reason. The policy concerns are the concerns that arise in the case of recantations, that they are inherently suspect, that they are possibly the result of undue influence or coercion, that sort of thing.
I can understand that. The guy's pled, he's been sentenced, he's in prison, and he doesn't have to be in prison. And now you have a recantation, you got to do the whole thing over again. You don't want to do that. But you're not there. This is a pre-sentence situation. There's been very little time spent on this by the DA's office or by the court, and now you're going to put in a lot of time. I understand about recantation, especially post-sentence.
The state's position is that these concerns about recantation are as present before sentencing as they are after sentencing. They're a concern before sentencing as well, and whatever rule this court adopts should reflect that.
So what's the difference between your post-sentence and pre-sentence rule?
The difference is, primarily, that the fifth McCollum criteria, the requirement that a defendant show a reasonable probability of a different outcome at trial, would not be part of the pre-sentence rule. The state is not proposing that this court require defendants to show a reasonable probability of a different outcome at trial pre-sentence. And that is in recognition of the fact that the state's interest in the finality is so much greater after sentencing. That's why it makes sense that a defendant should have to show a reasonable probability of a different outcome in that situation.
Why should there be much difference? I mean, well, maybe at least in some cases there's not been a sentencing evaluation, whatever you call pre-sentence report, et cetera. But I would imagine by the time you get to, you've had a plea, certain things start in motion, don't they? There's a pre-sentence report, there's an examination, witnesses are told to go home. What's the difference? I like your rule. And I'm trying to think why you should treat post-sentence differently than pre-sentence. And that, because I recognize from your brief that you are treating this entirely differently. You're withdrawing that fifth factor. And in fact, I think you're placing a lesser burden, are you not?
Yes.
Why are you doing that? What is so different about pre-sentence as opposed to post?
Only that the state's interest in finality is less. It is less before sentencing. And the ABA standards on which Wisconsin has based its two standards, manifest injustice versus fair and just reason, emphasize that pre-sentence plea withdrawal should be more liberally granted than post-sentence plea withdrawal. And that's the reason that the state has tried to craft a rule that would respect that difference and yet still be workable, still provide a reasonable standard under which judges can look at new evidence and particularly recantation.
Can you discern any problems in terms of the administration of justice by allowing a simple recantation and nothing more at a pre-sentence withdrawal?
Yes.
Such as?
The state's major concern is that if the rule adopted by this court is that a recantation is a per se fair and just reason, then the criminal defendants have every incentive after entering a plea to pressure state's witnesses to recant. If they can pressure a state's witness to come up to bring in a plausible recantation and all we have is a per se fair and just reason rule, they get automatic withdrawal of their plea. The state believes that the better rule as a matter of policy removes any incentive, as much as you can remove, for defendants to apply that kind of pressure to the state's witnesses after they've pled.
Counsel, before the defendant pleads, there would be an incentive to get the state's witness to recant. Isn't there? There's always an incentive to get the witness to recant, right? Not only after a plea, right? Because if this witness recanted, this gentleman may not have ever pled at all. So the incentive has always been there. And I think the difference between pre-sentence and post-sentence is that a defendant, after he is sentenced, finds out he's getting more than he had hoped for, or maybe that his defense counsel had suggested he might get, or that the state had recommended, and so that now he's gotten a sentence heavier than he had hoped, or he may be in prison and he likes it less than he thought he was going to like it, and so there's a great incentive on his part to withdraw that plea, get back to jail and try and have a trial. That's the difference, I think, between pre-sentence and post-sentence.
That is an important difference, and that is one of the reasons why the standard is higher on post-sentence.
And I agree with that.
But still, pre-sentence plea withdrawal is not an automatic right.
And I'm not suggesting it is.
Still more than a mere change of heart is required. And for example, in this case, what happened here is that the co-defendant, Jody Steele, was sentenced after Mr. Kibioja pled, and before Mr. Kibioja was sentenced himself. So while in this case, this particular defendant did not wait until he got the bad news about his own sentence, he did wait until he got the bad news about his co-defendant's sentence before he made the decision to bring a plea withdrawal motion. Of course, the recantation also didn't happen until...
And I don't know where that gets us.
Well, I think that that's one of the things that can go on, though, is that Mr. Kibioja didn't know what his own sentence was going to be.
That's right.
But he did find out what Mr. Steele was sentenced to. And had this worked the way that it was intended to work, Mr. Steele would not have been sentenced until after Mr. Kibioja. Mr. Kibioja would not have known about the severity of his co-defendant's sentence in advance of Mr. Kibioja being sentenced himself.
And on the other hand, sentence is very individualized, isn't it? And so one can always say, well, he was more at fault than I, so I'm going to get less. And I've been a better man than he has in all the years we've been alive. So it doesn't gets us somewhere, but not that far either. It's not like he had gotten sentenced and really now knew he was going to get X number of years, and the light has has come upon him.
That is true.
The recanter here, of course, it appears, thought he was going to get charitable treatment from the state for telling on his accomplice. And when he got 20 years in prison and 10 years probation, he thinks the state took advantage of me. Now, I'll see it to it that the state can't convict another. That's the way it looks.
He certainly expressed some considerable anger over the severity of his own sentence in the letter in which he recanted. I would like to...
And it was my fault. I interrupted you. You finished on when recantation is the new evidence. The trial court is required to determine the reasonable indicia of reliability under the totality of circumstances. Spontaneity, amount and quality of collaboration, self-incrimination of recanting witness, and that the recantation is under oath and subject to subject to cross-examination. You had additional...
I was going to add that this list is not exhaustive and that no one factor is dispositive. A trial court could conclude that a recantation lacks reasonable indicia of reliability where the recantation is accompanied by some indicia of reliability but is deficient with regard to others. In this way, the state is effectively modeling the reasonable indicia of reliability standard on the... on this court's decision in State v. Brown, which is cited in the state's brief at page 14, and also this court's decision in State v. McConaughey, which is not cited in the state's brief, but which is at 121 Wis 2D 57. In both cases, the issue was whether exculpatory hearsay was accompanied by sufficient indicia of reliability that the defendants had a due process right to the admission of the evidence. In both cases, some indicia of reliability were present, but other indicia were absent. And this court concluded, based on the totality of the circumstances, that the proffered hearsay was not accompanied by sufficient indicia of reliability. And by the way, the state proposes that the standard of review on the question of whether the recantation is accompanied by reasonable indicia of reliability would be like that used in State v. Brown, the clearly erroneous standard of review.
Ms. Tarver, if we were to apply the test that you're proposing in this particular case, what do you think the result should be?
The result should be that this court determines from an independent review of the record that Jody Steele's recantation lacks reasonable indicia of reliability for the following reasons. And by the way, in reaching its decision, the trial court found that the reliability of Mr. Steele's recantation was seriously challenged. The state agrees for the following reasons. First, the timing of Mr. Steele's recantation seriously depreciates its reliability. He recanted only after what he received what he considered to be an extremely harsh sentence in light of his earlier willingness to cooperate with the police. He entered a plea in October 1995, nearly a year passed. In September 1996, Jody Steele was sentenced to 20 years in prison in order to pay restitution of approximately $13,000. He was angry at the length of his sentence. In a letter in which he expressed his anger, he recanted 1 month after he was sentenced. Under these circumstances, the timing of his recantation seriously depreciates its reliability. Also, as found by the trial court, the recantation was not corroborated by other evidence in the case. And the recantation was not corroborated under the reasoning of State v. McCollum either. Under State v. McCollum, which was an interesting case because of the fact that it was a sex assault case where the state's only evidence to begin with was the uncorroborated assertion of accusation of the victim. When the victim recanted, the defendant had a problem. There was really no way to produce corroboration. There was no corroboration of the original accusation, so there was no way to even corroborate in that case the recantation either. And this court said that it would find corroboration if the recanting witness provided a feasible motive for the original accusation, and there were sufficient indicia of reliability present. And in that case, the court found sufficient indicia of reliability because the testimony was the recantation was under oath. It was internally consistent, and it was consistent with circumstances at the time of the original accusation.
And when you're involved in reasonable motive for testifying, that would involve all credibility or not?
Let me put it this way. I think in the context of the test that the state is proposing, it would go to feasibility. But the state recognizes that the concepts, that the legal concepts, reliability and credibility are not mutually exclusive. And sometimes something that goes to reliability in one context may also go to credibility in another. But the state is proposing that these things go to the reliability of a recantation and that the court should be permitted to look at them. For reasons that I don't know that I need to go into in great detail, it's in the state's brief, Mr. Steele's recantation lacked internal consistency. It was not internally consistent in the way that the recantation was in State v. McCallum, and the state's position is that under the reasoning of State v. McCallum, Jody Steele's recantation is not corroborated.
Do you have any smoking guns? You have the letter written by Mr. Steele, and then you have the testimony by Mr. Steele. Is there anything in the record that you can point to that says he's lying? This is absolutely wrong.
Well, we have the inconsistency with regard to the Meissenberg burglary, which I think you were asking about before.
Yeah, but I mean, can you tell me when he was testifying, he was lying because he was in jail? Can you do that?
There is no corroborating evidence that he was in jail in the record in this case, and no evidence that he wasn't. I mean, nothing to confirm one way or the other that I know of.
Should there have been in this case? I mean, was there an opportunity to put in that kind of evidence?
Yes, I believe there was an opportunity for the defendant to put in corroborating evidence in this case, and that was not done. Moving on, Jody Steele's recantation was also not against his penal interest, and therefore it lacks the assurances of reliability that accompany a statement against the penal interest of the recanting witness. First, this is not a typical recantation against the penal interest of the recanting witness, because typically a witness makes the original accusation under oath. As a result, when the witness later recants, the witness is admitting to having committed perjury by testifying falsely under oath at the time of the original accusation. In this way, the recantation is against the penal interest of the witness. Here, Jody Steele did not make the original accusation under oath. The recantation was his first statement under oath. And because the original accusation was not under oath, Mr. Steele did not open himself up to charges of perjury as a result of the recantation.
But wouldn't his new testimony be subject to charges of perjury?
Not if he maintains that he's telling the truth. He's not yet recanted another time and gone back on the statement that he made under oath. As far as I know, once he recanted, he stuck with that story.
But his original story, was that under oath?
No.
Okay.
I see that my red light has gone on.
You have another question, counsel.
If Mr. Steele comes back and testifies under oath and testifies falsely, I mean, isn't he opening himself up to more than 20 years, a new felony charge?
If the recantation is untrue, and he is charged, and that is proven, yes. But typically, what is seen as against the penal interest of the recanting witness is not that he's lying when he recants, but that by recanting, he's admitting he lied before. That much you know for sure when you're dealing with a recanting witness. He's admitting he lied before. And if the first time he testified he was under oath, he's admitting he committed perjury. There are no further questions on this case.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kawati, you have 5 minutes rebuttal.
We have a recantation. That recantation is under oath. As I recall, in a criminal case, if somebody makes testimony under oath, it is under the penalty of perjury. As I recall, that penalty of perjury in a criminal case in the state of Wisconsin is a 5-year felony just for committing that perjury. We have no other statements from Jody Steele. Somewhere along the line, does the state of Wisconsin give any more credibility to a statement under oath than one not made under oath? I think that is part of what this court will have to decide. Secondly, in the state's own brief, it again says, it concedes there is no corroboration requirement in this case. Yet I find it hard to distinguish that from what the state is saying when it says it wants a new rule of reasonable indicia of reliability. Aren't these two just slices of the same pie? I think they are. The state has offered no authority for any of its dreamed-up rules for plea withdrawal and credibility determinations for pre-sentence plea withdrawal. Nothing. If you want to look in the federal law under Rule 32, and I think it's Rule 32E of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, is based on a 1927 U.S. Supreme Court case which fleshed out the original fair and just reason rule. I have that cite with me if the court would like to have it. It's cited in the U.S. Supreme Court case of Hyde. I just may say that for the record. That citation is 117 Supreme Court Reporter, 1630, 1997, U.S. Supreme Court. Nowhere in state or federal law under the fair and just reason standard is there anything like the state is proposing. There's just no authority for it. Further, in the state's argument, it implicated, and so too in its brief, that there are several months that go before, that go between the time of my client's entry of his plea and his withdrawal. Well, that's not exactly the case. If you look at page 4 of my blue-covered brief, my original brief in chief, I'll just read from it shortly. It gives a strict chronology of the record. It reads, quote,